You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Andrew Bodo. I represent Thomas H. Roberts in this appeal. We stand before the Court on a simple principle. The Virginia State Bar is an agent of this Court, and the Bar cannot be allowed to act arbitrarily in the exercise of its disciplinary authority. And for this reason, Mr. Roberts challenges the findings of misconduct under Rule 1.15b5 and Rule 1.15a32. I will address these issues in B5, A32, and then if time permits, I will also get into the procedural due process issue that we raise in our assignments of error as to the appeal. So first, with respect to the Rule B5, the analysis should be fairly simple. This is a rule that says the attorney cannot take the client's money without consent. There's a comment on that rule, comment 2A, that specifically says, with respect to B5, consent can be inferred from the representation agreement. In this case, we do have a representation agreement. And on page 333 of the joint appendix, you'll find that representation agreement where we're not merely relying on some inference from the representation agreement, but the express language of that agreement that says the client agrees that the money in trust can be applied to pay the fees. That's an express language of the contract. So we don't merely have to rely on an inference.
But doesn't that presuppose there's an agreement on what the fees are?
No, I don't think it does, because the question about the total amount of the fees or how the issue would be calculated is different from the question about whether there is consent to actually apply the balance to whatever fees.
Well, if I were a client signing off on that, I would think the understanding would be, look, sure, you can pay your fees out of the trust account, of course. Unless I'm telling you, your fees are exaggerated or fraudulent. I mean, that would be implicit in any agreement like that.
Oh, well, I think that if that's the case, then this is not a violation of B5, but a violation of one of the other rules of professional conduct, like A32. And that's part of the point, is we have to look at the specific rule. And the specific rule says there has to be consent, and there's a comment, an official comment that says consent can be inferred from the representation agreement. And we have it explicit in the representation.
I'm agreeing with you. Consent can be inferred. It's expressed in the agreement. But doesn't it presuppose that you're not objecting to the charge on the account? Doesn't it presuppose that, that's a proper charge and take it from the trust account, of course?
I can see your point. Without conceding, I can see your point. But that there is the other issue of, was there actually a dispute? Was there a clear dispute at that time? Because the transfer was made in April 2016. And this was after she had filed a bill of particulars. In the lawsuit she filed against the firm. A bill of particulars that did not address the trust balance, did not raise the issue of the money in trust, did not ask for that money back, as she well could have in that court.
But she had earlier, in October 2015, directly asked for her $150.
Correct. And between that time and the bill of particulars, she had retained an attorney who had communicated with the firm. We have the emails in the file. She then filed a lawsuit. She then filed a bill of particulars. And by that time, the situation looked so different. Now, if Mr. Roberts misevaluated facts, looking at this rule and said, we have a representation agreement. We have that says we can apply the money to fees. It doesn't look like there is a dispute. It looks like we have the client's consent. That's an inference. That's him taking that inference to say that the dispute has been, or that he has consent to apply the fees. The Virginia State Bar has come along and created arguments that either ignore the rule, ignore the comment, ignore the contract, or ignore the contract law. And in the arguments that they put forward to this court, trying to ignore one of those components, let alone several of those components, creates due process concerns. If the bar wants to have this position that an attorney raising a dispute about the scope of the fees withdraws consent, that should be expressed somewhere in the LEO. That should be expressed somewhere in the comments. It should be expressed somewhere in the case law. It's not. And that is creates the due process notice issue with the application of law in this way. Going back to the Volkswagen v. Smith case from 2010. Now, turning then to with respect to the Rule A3 violation, this is a rule that does appear at first glance to have some substance, have some merit. But as you try to apply this rule to a more complicated case than what the court has had to deal with in the past, where there's a dispute about whether a dispute has been resolved, the rule breaks down very quickly. And it allows the bar to act arbitrarily in the enforcement of this rule. To put the matter simply, Mr. Roberts had $150 in trust. The client claimed it, earlier, back in October, that she was entitled to the money back. She didn't state the foundation of that claim, and the contract language seemed clear on this point. She also disputed the firm's lien. She then filed a lawsuit with counsel, and that lawsuit, that bill of particulars, instead of demanding the repayment of the trust, her bill of particulars actually conceded that Mr. Roberts was entitled to quantum merit fees. Her bill of particulars conceded the firm the fact that the firm staff had worked on this case. And a prior email between the counsel, or from the counsel, which you see on page 385 of the joint appendix, also conceded these points as well. The firm was entitled to quantum merit fees, and the firm had worked on the case.
Wasn't she understanding quantum merit in this context to be quantum merit fees against an ultimate recovery?
There's no evidence in the record of that. That's the bar's position. That's the position the bar has taken. But there's no evidence in the record that she took it. In fact, when she was asked directly about
the deal Mr. Roberts made with a personal injury claimant is, look, you're going to pay me a contingency fee if we win, and if we lose, I'm still going to sue you for quantum merit fees, and I'll tell you what's reasonable later. That was the deal?
No, that's not the deal, and nor is that the facts of the case. In this case, the issue is, he made an agreement, a contingency fee agreement, and the client terminated the law firm before we got to litigation.
I'm trying to figure out what you mean by quantum merit in the context of a personal injury retainer agreement.
That can be clarified by the Heisman decision, footnote 4, wherein the Heisman decision says that that the quantum merit is the reasonable value or reason value of the attorney's services, not the value rendered to the client. Not the value rendered to the client.
So in a personal injury retainer context, that's what that means, that if you lose the case and you're a personal injury lawyer, you don't get your 35% or whatever you negotiate, you still get fees no matter what?
No. That's Heisman and this case both deal with the client terminating the law firm before there's a win or a loss. And so this is not a question about a loss. There was no loss in this case.
I realize that's not this case. I'm asking you what the clause means from your perspective under a hypothetical. And the hypothetical is you don't get fired, a new firm doesn't take over, you take it to trial, you lose, and you still say, but I gave you an enormous amount of valuable legal services, and I intend to be paid for it. Is that what you're saying that
no.
clause means?
Our position has never been that position. Our position has been that if Mr. Roberts took this case to trial and lost, he would not be entitled to any fees.
Okay, so quantum merit then is preconditioned in this context to an actual recovery.
No, quantum merit, because quantum merit, you're assuming that the quantum merit is in the event of termination, that quantum merit is contingent on the recovery. That's not the case law of Virginia. Virginia has no case law on that point, that the quantum merit fees for an attorney, if the client terminates the attorney, is contingent on the recovery. Moreover, there's no appeal, there's no case law, there's no comment on this point. There's no clarity in Virginia law on this point. And the district committee expressly found that it was not going to find any violation based on that theory. That district committee determination is final and binding. This court cannot come back and say that it finds some violation in derogation of the findings of the committee determination. The committee determination on that at this point was final. It was expressed in the determination.
Let me ask you this. On A3.2 talks about until the dispute is resolved, and B5 talks about not dispersing except as directed by a tribunal. So agreeing with everything you've said, that is that she conceded, yep, you get quantum merit, yep, you did some work on the case, etc., as I understood the bar's position, the problem wasn't all of that. The problem was he took into himself the decision to take this very small amount of money in the grand scheme of things. But the authority to do that rested in the first instance with a tribunal and until the dispute was resolved, which clearly it wasn't. Is that the problem that we have?
I don't think so. The bar has abandoned the position, because if they have ever taken that position, they've abandoned the position that a formal adjudication is required to resolve the dispute. That's in their bar brief. They've now abandoned that position if that was ever their position. However, what we have is passive voice in the rule. The dispute is resolved. It doesn't say who resolves the dispute, how the dispute is resolved.
Well, look, there's a lawsuit pending where she says you...
The lawsuit pending is only about the lien, and that's actually part of the committee determination. Paragraph 20 says that the lawsuit pending was only about the lien. That lien is on the proceeds of the cause of action. It has nothing to do with this trust balance, which is not part of the proceeds on the cause of action. It is a complicated analysis trying to get through all this because the rule is unclear. You're borrowing from another rule, B5, in order to try to incorporate it into A32 to provide some clarity, some subject to the passive voice. And that's simply not a clear way of analyzing the A32. In this case, they are trying to drag in B5, and we believe that's inappropriate.
But the rules fit together, though, right? I mean, they're part of a comprehensive whole. So I don't know why we would necessarily segment or why it's improper to say another rule that's getting at the same problem is utterly irrelevant to the overall purpose of these rules.
It's not a question of relevancy or irrelevancy. It's not a question of whether or not it is a colorable interpretation. The question is, what did it provide adequate notice to Mr. Roberts that this would be the way that it would be interpreted?
Surely you understand what you're up against in trying to argue something is void for vagueness. There's not a whole lot of those out there. Volkswagen is one. But at any rate, proceed with your argument.
Well, if I may, I'll save the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Madeline Gibson, and I'm here on behalf of the Virginia State Bar. This is a clear case. What this case is about is an attorney who paid himself a legal fee from client funds while they were in the middle of a fee dispute that implicated those funds, and after his client had twice requested in writing a return of those funds. In taking that money at that time, Mr. Roberts showed a disregard for his responsibilities under the rules of professional conduct. And in so doing, he not only betrayed the trust of his client, but it was the kind of conduct that jeopardizes the reputation and respectability of our legal profession.
Well, help me understand what the bar's position is then, because we've heard from your opposing counsel about what is or isn't in play and the role of this bill of particulars. So exactly which part of the rules is still in play at this stage?
Justice McCullough,
in other words, he's saying you abandon certain arguments, and so precisely what language in the rule did he violate? Of these rules did he violate?
In Rule 1.15A32, there was a dispute over the fee, and it wasn't a dispute over a portion of that $5,700 and some. It was the entire amount was in dispute.
Okay, and if I understand his argument, he's saying, well, the bill of particulars clarified what at that stage was and wasn't in dispute. Is that wrong?
That's incorrect, yes. Okay. That's incorrect, Your Honor.
All right. I'm just trying to get at where the nub of the dispute between the parties is.
Okay. And to complete my answer, Your Honor, that it was the entire sum that was in dispute. There, as As Your Honor said, there was obviously no resolution of that dispute. And what he was commanded to do clearly under A32 was to leave the funds in the trust accounts until there was resolution. And moreover, of course, under 1.15b5, he clearly did not have the client's authorization to take that money at the fee at that time. And that's the bar's position on that. Under the rules, attorneys are held to a higher standard of conduct than just simply following Virginia law. And that's why it's immaterial whether or not Mr. Roberts had lawfully entered into this representation agreement with Ms. Hayes. The lawfulness of the representation agreement is immaterial because what we're talking about is the higher standard that was applied to him under the rules. Did he satisfy that standard? Under Hindman, the clear answer is no. The principle of Hindman is that an attorney cannot waive his client's rights or avoid his responsibilities under the rules through terms in a fee agreement, in a representation agreement. That's prohibited by Hindman, and that's because of this special relationship between attorneys and clients and the rights and responsibilities that are intrinsic to that relationship in every aspect of that relationship, including when entering into a representation agreement. And that's supported by Legal Ethics Opinion 1606, which adopts the language of Hindman and states that, in fact, attorneys can be disciplined for putting certain fee terms in their representation agreement that are prohibited under the rules. And in this case, whether or not the relevant language in the representation agreement here was enforceable at the time they entered the agreement, and the bar's position is that it wasn't enforceable at that time, but whether or not it was, the subsequent communications from Ms. Hayes to Mr. Roberts were clear, and Mr. Roberts could not, under Hindman and Legal Ethics Opinion 1606, he could not rely on the four corners of the representation agreement to the exclusion of all subsequent communications from his client. He was required to heed what she was saying. He was required to pay attention to the fact that she had sent him two letters saying, I would like my money back. You can take costs and expenses, but then I want the remainder of my money back. And they were in the middle of a fee dispute. All of the evidence is clear here, and the standard of review that applies to this court's review of the fact findings of the disciplinary board is highly deferential, and a reasonable view of the evidence in a light most favorable to the bar shows clearly that Mr. Roberts violated both 1.15A32 and 1.15B5.
Well, let's address the appellant's brief at the bottom of page 6, top of page 7 says the bill of particulars did not reference the balance in trust and did not claim the law firm owed her money. Instead, it requested a determination as to the amount of the firm's statutory lien on the cause of action. Is that accurate?
Well, Your Honor, how
does that fit with what you just said about the facts?
Your Honor, the facts are clear that the entire amount of the fee was in dispute, whether or not the specific trust account funds were mentioned. And because the entire amount was in dispute, implicitly and clearly, Ms. Hayes was disputing Mr. Roberts' right to take any legal fee, period, from her at that time. There was no agreement that because the $143.30 in the trust account wasn't mentioned in the bill of particulars, that's not to say that she agreed that he could take that money. The entire amount was in dispute. There was no agreement that he could take a fee. Moreover, as Justice Kelsey mentioned, there's also testimony from Ms. Hayes that she never agreed at the outset that Mr. Roberts could take a legal fee when she hadn't even had a recovery. She states in testimony that she had no understanding that would be the case because she had no understanding of where the fee would be coming from. There would be no recovery. So at the outset, there was no consent to that. I would like to turn my attention to the vagueness arguments. Initially, this court should not consider the facial vagueness challenge because under Motley and under Volkswagen and under U.S. Supreme Court precedents, when First Amendment interests are not threatened by a rule or by a statute, the clarity of the law should not be reviewed on facial grounds. And as applied, the challenge, as applied to the facts at hand, the challenge equally lacks merit. Rule 1.15a through 2 gave very clear, fair notice to Mr. Roberts of what was prohibited and what was commanded under the rule. And this case is similar in that respect to the Motley case, where the rule at issue was what is now 1.4, which states that an attorney must keep his client reasonably informed of the matters happening in his case. And the facts of that case were that an attorney had failed to inform his client that his criminal appeal had been denied in time for him to seek review from this court. And this court stated that the conduct commanded under Rule 1.4 was beyond any question, quote, beyond any question. And that's the case we have here. Rule 1.15A32 says that in the case where there are competing claims to funds, an attorney must leave those funds in the trust account until there's resolution of the dispute.
Are my facts right that Mr. Roberts has an associate that replied in response to the August 2015 request for the escrow that the balance of the trust account be returned to you?
That's correct, Your Honor. He did say that. Which is even more evidence that it's very unclear how and when Mr. Roberts justified his conduct. There was every apparently intention to return the money. And
she asked for it. The associate says, come get it. She asked for it again, and then Mr. Roberts takes it out and puts it in his own account in the midst of a dispute over the fee.
And that's exactly the essence of this case. He took clearly disputed funds. There's no vagueness here as applied to Mr. Roberts in this case. And finally, turning my attention to the procedural due process challenge, the Kuczynski case out of this court in 2014 controls the due process, the process that is due to an attorney in disciplinary proceedings. And in that case, this court stated very clearly that what an attorney is due is to be informed of the charges of misconduct and to be afforded an opportunity to answer those charges. And this court then said that the entire process due to an attorney is contained and satisfied by the procedures in Part 6 of the Rules of the Supreme Court of Virginia. And in this case, the pertinent part of Part 6 is Section 4, Paragraph 13-19, which states that the parties are entitled, shall have oral argument unless waived, and that the disciplinary board is restricted to reviewing the findings of the district committee. There is no limitation on the substance of argument, which is what Mr. Roberts has argued, and moreover, the order out of the disciplinary board shows clearly that the only charges of misconduct that they considered were these two charges that are on appeal today before this court. There was no amendment of the charges. There was no, in short, deprivation of due process to Mr. Roberts in this case. In conclusion, the bar respectfully requests that this court affirm the board's findings.
Rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. I'll make two very brief points. First of all, the bar brings up the Leo 1606. The more pertinent Leo is actually 1812, which specifically indicates that attorneys can have alternative fee provisions in contingency fee contracts that become operative once an attorney or once the client terminates the contingency fee representation agreement. That's Leo 1812. That is the more pertinent Leo in this case, not Leo 1606. That Leo justifies this sort of contract language. This is not an attorney waiving the client's rights. This is an attorney putting out a representation agreement, asking the client to consider it, and the client wrote that you read and understood it immediately adjacent to this provision. That's on page 333 of the joint appendix. Also, the bar continues to say that the reason why we have the A3...
Counsel?
Yes?
Now, I see 333. Going back to 323 through 330, this screams that there is a continuing, rather angry dispute between the client and the attorney. I understand your argument, but how could any attorney, knowing that the client feels that way and that strongly, say, I'm going to take the money no matter what. I don't care.
What I would point to is if you look at 385, the last line on the first page of 385, there's the acknowledgement from the opposing counsel that you would be entitled to some quantum merit fee. And then when the bill of particulars comes out not challenging that trust money, Mr. Roberts actually has the duty to determine whether whether that fee is in dispute now. And if he determines that the fee is in dispute, he has to leave the money in trust and potentially be sanctioned by the bar for leaving money in trust that he should have taken out and applied to his account. Or he had to pull the money out of the trust.
Yeah, I'm sorry, is your argument that if he had not taken this money out of trust, he might have been sanctioned by the bar?
Yes, under the same exact rule. 832 allows them to sanction him for leaving the money in trust after the dispute is resolved. And so if he determined, or if he looked at this and thought that the dispute was resolved and left the money in trust, he could potentially be sanctioned. He had no option to avoid no option that would clearly put him in a safe harbor. No option that would clearly avoid sanction.
Has he answered your question? All right, your time has expired. The court will be in recess until 5 minutes until 11.
All right.
Go ahead. I've got it. The only way to resolve this, no problem, we have a wardrobe malfunction.